we're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
From the Center for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Natasha Moore. This week, as you're probably aware, marks 100 years since the end of World War I. For the last 4 years, we've, some of us anyway, might have been noting these centenaries as they go by. The outbreak of war, Gallipoli, the Battle of the Somme, year by year, anniversary by anniversary. I have a weird kind of personal sense of the duration of this, because I started working here at CPX not long before the centenary of the start of the war in August 2014. One of the early Life and Faith episodes I did was about that. And you know, this whole 4 years I've been doing this job, living my life, it feels like a pretty solid span of time. And 100 years ago, that same span was how long this horrific war dragged on for, year after year after year. And here we are at the end. It's hard to imagine how overpowering the relief must have been in November 1918, to hear that it was finally over. But at the same time, it's a difficult anniversary to know what to do with exactly. It's hard to be jubilant about it, partly because the war itself was so long and so futile. You know, really, what was it all for? But partly also because we know what came after. I mean, if the First World War killed 15 million people, well, the Spanish flu epidemic, which started before the war was even over and lasted until the end of 1920, maybe 500 million people around the world got it, including people on remote Pacific islands and in the Arctic, and more than 50 million people died. That was one out of every 20 people who were alive at the time, one in 20. It's way more than died in the war and in a shorter span of time. And of course, looking back from our vantage point, we see how the end of World War I sows the seeds for the start of World War II. You look at the happy faces of the people in the photos from November 11, 1918, and you think of what these people are still going to face in their lifetimes. And it's pretty sobering. So here on Life and Faith, we wanted to mark the centenary without being triumphalist about it, I guess. The ripple effects of that conflict on those who survived it and on our world since are incalculable. And the numbers involved are so great, it becomes a bit numbing to think about it. So we want to share with you the story of one particular soldier and the ripple effects of his life and, spoiler alert, death. His name was Elvis Jenkins, E-L-V-A-S, not I-S. And he was the subject of a documentary that my colleague Alan Douthwaite was involved in making a few years back. The documentary is from Bible Society Australia. It's called The Bullet in the Bible. And we're going to bring you some sections from it for today's episode. This story is narrated by Robin Powell. Here's how it starts.
There are few locations in the world so serene and untroubled in aspect as the fields of Picardy in northern France, at least today. The roots of the plants that grow here sink down into soil fertilized by a generation of tears. This was the ground on which the Battle of the Somme took place. It was the largest offensive in World War I, and one of the bloodiest battles in human history. In just under 6 months, more than 1 million men were wounded or killed. British, French, Russian, Italian, German, Australians, and New Zealanders. On the outskirts of the rural village of Mametz lies the Danzig Alley British War Cemetery, a brotherhood of the fallen brought together by the British Empire, and resting amongst them, Queenslanders, Western Australians, New South Welshmen, and the grave of one particular Victorian, the first member of the 1st Australian Division to die on the Western Front. Elvis Elliot Jenkins was born on January 6, 1888. The first son of James and Bertha Jenkins in what would become a family of seven. At the age of 12, Elvis moved with his family to Ivanhoe on the outskirts of bustling Melbourne, where he attended Fairfield State High. There, he'd earn report cards that labelled him high-spirited, fond of fun, and full of mischief. In Ivanhoe, Elvis became an enthusiastic member of the local Methodist Church. At 15, he left school to become an apprentice printer. And in 1910, he left the printing trade to train as a Methodist minister.
And with infinite regret, His Majesty's government have been compelled to put this country in a state of war with what for many years, and indeed generations past, has been a friendly power.
The Empire was at war, and Australia would answer the call. Elvis Jenkins was only halfway through his studies to become a Methodist minister. He was taking a break on his brother's farm when news of the war reached these shores.
When the German armies invaded Belgium in the first days of World War I, they did engage in a range of very oppressive behaviour, which was depicted at the time as atrocities.
A quick pause here. This is Professor Joan Beaumont. She's an historian at ANU who specialises in the Australian experience of war. After her, we'll hear from the Reverend Dr. Colin Bale, a church historian who works on war graves, of all things. Back to the reports of atrocities.
Which fueled this idea that the British Empire and Australia as part of it were fighting a system, a political system that was barbaric, militaristic, anti-Christian and so on.
That gets picked up, I think, more and more as the war goes on and as propaganda kicks in. And so some of the propaganda material really does push this idea about the barbarity of the Germans, or of the Huns as they became known, and therefore trying to encourage people to see this as more than just a fight against Britain's enemies, but a fight for civilization and, in a sense, bringing about the sort of society that God wants.
Elvis would be one of 420,000 volunteers embarking on this great adventure.
I think the concept of the war being a great adventure would have been very short-lived, perhaps lasting the first few months when men were being transported to Egypt as it happened, and really waiting in Egypt for something to happen. I think as soon as they were committed to action, any concept of this being an adventure would have been rapidly dispelled.
Enlisting involved a real sacrifice for Elvis. It meant leaving behind 18-year-old Jeannie Reed, the love of his life. Like Elvis, Jeannie was one of seven children, though she was the youngest. Her father had died when she was seven, and she grew up a serious-minded girl, committed to her studies. That resolve brought her to Melbourne University, where she determined to study medicine. Jeannie's older sister had already become one of the early 20th century's greatest curiosities, a female doctor. And Jeannie's sights were set on becoming the same. However, while attending a Christian conference in Adelaide, her gaze was captured by something else altogether. A gentleman by the name of Elvis E. Jenkins. 85-year-old Andrew Jays is Jeannie Reed's son, and he grew up listening to his mother's stories of those turbulent days.
And she recalls that he took a sermon at the Methodist Church, which was part of the conference with the delegates attending, and she was very impressed with his sermon, and she remarks in her diary what an outstanding person he was and how she was very fond of him. So it must have happened fairly quickly. There were recreational activities, walks and the like, and studies in small groups. And she came to think Elvis was pretty good.
Jeannie began writing regularly to Elvis, and her thoughts would follow him to the sands of Egypt, the shores of Gallipoli, and the fields of France. None of Jeannie's letters remain. However, Elvis's replies leave little doubt about how he felt about her or the future he hoped they'd share.
Elvis says, "I am yours forever, with deepest love," and so forth. As I say, we've got plenty of evidence from Elvis' side that he saw it going that way.
There's another thread to this story of Elvis and Jeannie, the thread that led the documentary makers to uncover their story in the first place. Parallel to the history of Elvis and World War I is the history of a particular artifact, a Bible from 1914, that turned up again not so long ago. In this section, as well as Robin, you're going to hear from two men who, just to confuse you, are both called John Harris. There's John Harris, who works for Bible Society Australia and is an Australian historian, and John Paul Harris, who lectures in the Department of War Studies at Royal Military Academy Sandhurst in the UK. You'll be able to tell them apart by their accents, at least.
What is now Bible Society Australia was begun under Governor Lachlan Macquarie in 1817 and is the oldest continuously operating organisation in Australia. At the outset of World War I, it was determined to ensure every Aussie digger could have a Bible as part of his kit.
Well, Elvis obviously had one. I mean, everybody had one in the First World War. And I think, given the character of the man, that he gave it away. Well, they were near Alexandria, and we all know that soldiers on their days off went into Alexandria and Cairo for all sorts of reasons. And Elvis, being a decent Christian chap, it seems to me that he went looking for a Christian community. And he would have found one in the French Quarter in Alexandria. And that's where he obtained his French Protestant Bible. And it was obviously very, very dear to him. He may even have exchanged his Bible Society issue Bible for that, but we don't know that. But certainly it mattered a lot to him, mattered enough to him to be the one that he carried in his breast pocket.
On April 1st, 1915, Elvis would have received the news that all leave was cancelled in preparation for the Anzac's transportation from Egypt to the island of Lemnos. Here they rendezvoused with British and French troops in preparation for an all-out assault on the Turkish Dardanelles. The Dardanelles is a narrow strait linking the Mediterranean with the Black Sea. So long as Turkey controlled this strategic waterway, it would have a stranglehold over any supplies Britain might hope to send to its Russian allies.
I think the idea was to try to knock Turkey out of the war shortly after it had come into the war. Winston Churchill, the First Lord of the Admiralty, was particularly keen on this. The troops, which Churchill was told would be available for an assault on the Dardanelles, were the 29th Division and the Anzac Corps. The Anzac Corps, Australian New Zealand Army Corps, a rather thrown together organisation of really excellent human material, enthusiastic men who wanted to serve the Empire, had volunteered to do so, were in many cases very good physical specimens, but who hadn't really been fully trained for the kind of complex mission which they would have to carry out.
On April 25th, 1915, at 4:30 in the morning, newly promoted Lance Corporal Elvis Jenkins was amongst the first troops to land. But poor planning plagued the invasion from the outset. Elvis and the Anzacs were supposed to have landed on an open stretch of beach 1.5 kilometres to the south. Instead, as dawn's light bled into the sky, they were confronted by steep cliffs and ridges. They soared up to 90 metres in height and in many places came right down to the waterline. Under fire, the Anzac troops fought to climb the surrounding hills, dragging on bushes and plunging bayonets into the dirt to help themselves. Meantime, Elvis and the engineers were struggling to secure the landing. Unloading ammunition and supplies, constructing a pier to allow the heavy guns to come ashore, sinking wells to assure their water supply, shielded by hills from enemy artillery, but always under the eyes of enemy snipers. In the first 5 days of the landing, 23,292 Anzacs landed, and an estimated 5,000 died. And on May 7th, 1915, Elvis almost joined the long list of Gallipoli's casualties. Bible in his chest pocket as always, Elvis was in charge of a detail responsible for dragging artillery up to the battle lines. The Turkish army was shelling the Anzacs with German-made 75mm field guns, firing shells packed with explosives and lead balls. The shells exploded on impact, spraying the bullets in all directions, and one landed right where Elvis and his men were working.
Well, when it explodes, shrapnel goes everywhere. Some of that shrapnel is arbitrary material, but in this case, the shrapnel, or most of the shrapnel, was specially constructed, ball-bearing, or we're calling it a bullet, and one of those struck him right here in the Bible that he carried in his breast pocket, where most men carried them. Now, he had it back the front in his pocket, which means that because it was a New Testament Psalms, the bullet went through Psalms and then Revelation, and then went through all of Paul's epistles, and it stopped at John's Gospel. Elvis had seen many, many of his comrades die from such shrapnel bullets, but on this day, the bullet that ended his Bible didn't enter him, and the Bible saved his life.
Of course, if you know anything about the Gallipoli campaign, you know it was an abject failure. By the end of 1915, the War Office ordered the withdrawal of Allied troops. Joan Beaumont explains why.
The Gallipoli campaign really was too ambitious, it was too poorly planned, and in particular, a lot of the logistical support that was necessary if the initial landings were to be consolidated was pretty primitive and lacking.
Elvis had been one of the first in, and on December 27th, he was one of the last out. But sadly, he didn't retreat to safety.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. In today's episode for the centenary of the end of World War I, we're bringing you extracts from a documentary made a few years back called The Bullet in the Bible. It's got romance, travel, tragedy, a miraculous escape, and a sense of the very personal toll of this global event. It's narrated by Robin Powell, and in this section, you're going to hear interviews from John Paul Harris, Joan Beaumont, John Harris, and Colin Bale again. There's also a poetry reading coming up that packs a serious punch.
After their evacuation from Gallipoli, the Anzac troops returned first to Egypt before being transferred to the Western Front.
By June 1916, there's a very well-established entrenched stalemate on the Western Front. The German attempt to knock France out quickly in 1914 has failed. Both sides have dug in, and over much of the Western Front there are continuous lines of trenches, and it's becoming increasingly difficult for either side to break through. The French army was in crisis by June 1916. It was in an extreme crisis. It had taken massive casualties. The French army, therefore, was desperate that somebody would attack the Germans on the Western Front and take the pressure off.
Elvis's unit, along with three divisions of Anzacs, were assigned the role of spearheading an attack on the strong German entrenchment in and around the French village of Pozières. Today, the Somme region is composed of lush farmlands. But the Pozières Elvis Jenkins saw was quite a different landscape. Years of artillery had obliterated whole towns, few, if any, trees were left. And the countryside was sinking beneath a deadly sea of mud and barbed wire.
I think on both the home and the battle fronts, there was probably a growing despair about the inability of these terrible battles, particularly the Somme and the Third Ypres, it's often known as Passchendaele, to actually bring the war anywhere close to an end.
Pozières would be completely destroyed by the bombardments that rained down upon it. The main battle would take place on July 23rd, and it would be Australian troops who decided the outcome. And before the battle was over, 13,000 Australians would have given their lives. In the words of Australian historian Charles Bean, the Pozieres Ridge is more densely sown with Australian sacrifice than any other place on earth. A week before the main battle was to begin, Elvis was given command of a small reconnaissance party, charged with determining the precise location of the enemy trenches. Everything was going well when, without warning, a shot rang out. Elvis had been hit by a German sniper. The official report of his injuries is brutal and short. GSW. Gunshot wound. Later that day, the reliable Digger Jenkins died from his wounds. Back home, hearts would break over the news, and Spencer Jenkins, Elvis's brother, would write on the back of a photo of Jeannie, "Jeannie Reed became Dr. J. Reed." Elvis was going to marry Jean had he come back from the war. Their future together would be another casualty in a conflict historians still struggle to measure.
I think the real truth is nobody knows how many people died in the First World War. Most historians would go for about 15 million as the total number of fatalities in the war.
Australia, a tiny nation, paid a huge butcher's bill. Close to 62,000 men died in conflict, but many more died of their wounds soon after returning home. 145 men died for every 1,000 enlisted. It's hard to comprehend numbers on this scale, but the real tragedy of World War I is reflected well in a poem called "The Parable of the Old Man and the Young." It was written by soldier poet Wilfred Owen and reflects a Bible story about sacrifice that would have been very familiar to Elvis.
So Abram rose and clave the wood and went, and took the fire with him and a knife. And as they sojourned both of them together, Isaac the firstborn spake and said, "My father, behold the preparations, fire and iron, but where the lamb for this burnt offering?" Then Abram bound the youth with belts and straps and builded parapets and trenches there and stretched forth the knife to slay his son. When lo, an angel called him out of heaven, saying, "Lay not thy hand upon the lad, neither do anything to him. Behold, a ram caught in a thicket by its horns, offer the ram of pride instead of him." But the old man would not so, and slew his son. And half the seed of Europe, one by one.
If you are not familiar with the Bible story that poem references, you can read it in chapter 22 of the book of Genesis, Google it. It's about Abraham, father of the nation of Israel. God commands him to sacrifice his only son, Isaac. Only at the last moment, of course, God calls him off and instead provides the sacrifice himself. It's a shocking story. The shock of it doesn't really diminish down the ages. But the point of Owen's poem is that the political authorities on both sides of the war, unlike Abraham, refused mercy and opted for slaughter instead. It's one of the great kind of skewering poems that come out of the war. Wilfred Owen himself was killed in France on the 4th of November 1918, just a week before the armistice and the end of the war. To tie up the ends of Elvis and Jeannie's story, here's Robin and also John Harris, and then historians Joan Beaumont and Colin Bale reflect on the place of faith in the war and its aftermath.
In the century that followed, Elvis Jenkins' story was almost lost to Australia, were it not for a chance meeting at an exhibition of valuable Bibles.
A member of the Jays family, a descendant of Jeannie, came up to me and said, "Look, I've got this really interesting Bible that has been to Gallipoli." Didn't actually tell me anything more about it, but said, "You know, would the Bible Society be interested?" And I said, Well, the Bible Society is very interested in military Bibles. We've got an excellent collection and we'd like to add to it. It wasn't until then that I discovered there was a bullet in it.
The Jenkins and Jay's families had never heard each other's halves of Elvis's story. A love story, a life of sacrifice, a faith that survived the worst the century had to offer.
The first thing to say about World War I's impact on Australia is that certainly it did give birth to a stronger sense of national distinctiveness, if I can call it that. It reinforced the sense that Australians, particularly in battle, were different from the British. But it is completely erroneous to see this as the birth of Australian nationalism as we understand it today. And if anything, I would argue the value of loyalty to the British Empire was reinforced by World War I. But the impact on Australian society has to be seen as overwhelmingly negative. There was the human loss, not just the 60,000 plus dead, but at least 150,000 men came home grievously wounded, both physically and mentally. And then in many country towns, there had been meetings where people had stood up and said, "Your son has not volunteered and mine has." And people were named, people were stigmatised. So we have a society which I think was really very polarised. Probably much of the social fabric of communities have been damaged by World War I.
With regard to memorials and people's grief response after the war, they were still looking to God in many ways. It's not so evident on the public memorials, but it's certainly evident in their own thinking and their own way of expressing their remembrance. Now, I've worked on the headstones and the personal inscriptions that families chose, and the biggest group are the devotional, the religious ones. And by and large, they really focus on the Bible or on the words of hymns to express their sense of understanding of why this loss happened.
It's perfectly reasonable to suggest that some people lost their faith as a consequence of their experience of World War I. On the other hand, for some people, their faith was their only refuge.
In terms of the Australian military and how much soldiers believed and how Christian they were, it's much harder to work out. Historians in the past have tended to see the Australian soldier as not being very religious, but I don't think that's the full picture. I think Australian soldiers were far more religious than we give them credit for. They don't tend to sort of verbalise it in the way that we would probably expect. But when you look at some of the evidence, for example, chaplains, in terms of their reports back to the denominations, there's a great deal of enthusiasm for attending church services, being involved with the chaplains and so on. And when you look at the personal effects that were returned, particularly those men who died, usually there's a copy of the Bible or the New Testament there. There's that old saying that no one rejects God when they're in a trench or a foxhole. And I think to some extent that's true. What we see is people really start to think about life and death issues when they're confronted with life and death. And when you read the accounts, particularly on the Western Front, but the same is true of Gallipoli, all of a sudden these young men are really focused with this life and death issue. They could be dead in an instant. And in one sense, that's what you expect, because all of a sudden everything else is pushed away and all of a sudden we have to come with a reality. What is life about and what do we actually believe?
You've been listening to Life and Faith. I'm Natasha Moore. Our thanks to Bible Society Australia for letting us use parts of their 2015 documentary, The Bullet in the Bible. The full doco goes for an hour. If you have Foxtel, you can catch it this weekend on ACC TV, 1 p.m. Sunday, November 11. Or you can get the DVD through Koorong Bookstores. Go to koorong.com. As always, if you want to hear more episodes like this, including our other content about World War I and war and peace more generally, go to publicchristianity.org. Subscribe to Life and Faith so you don't miss new episodes on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. We're now on Spotify as well. Next week,
the sort of late modern feminist doesn't quite know what to do with the combination of Christianity being a radical force for women rather than merely a subjugating force for women. And as a Christian feminist myself, it matters a lot to me that we actually recover that history, whether or not we are Christians. It's part of the history of feminism.